good. How are you?
Good, good, good. So I've managed to wrangle you down to talk about shock, MAP, microperfusion, macroperfusion, and all this interesting stuff, I think.
Yeah.
It all kind of stemmed from the way I've been teaching the relationship of arterial blood pressure, or MAP, to that of microcirculatory flow, and all that in the context of a shocky patient whose blood pressure you are managing with vasopressors.
Mm-hmm.
So, at least for this argument's sake, not someone that you're volume resuscitating, but more that you're tweaking that pressure using the resistor. So there was this this graph that came out in a recent review article on blood pressure and sepsis by Jean-Louis Vincent and Claude Martin's group. And I thought it was really interesting because it's basically that graph. The base graph that they showed is basically that standard autoregulation kind of curve.
Mm-hmm.
And then they ran essentially a straightish line, just like when you sort of lose that autoregulation.
Yeah.
Essentially a straightish line relating organ blood flow to blood pressure. And they did put, you know, to their credit, they put their linear relationship is a theoretical one. But essentially that basically the higher your blood pressure is, the more organ blood flow you're getting. Which I'm not so convinced, just from the physical sense that you've got, in this case, you've got the resistor sitting between the pressure that we're measuring and the perfusion that we're hoping to achieve or whatnot. So I'd always been teaching it as a sort of inverted U type of thing, or at least with a flat part. And then once you get sort of the whole concept of being over vasoconstricted and decreasing your perfusion, I'd always taught it to my residents and students and things like that in that way. So I just wanted to know what your mental model for blood pressure to perfusion relationship is, and again, in this setting where that blood pressure is being increased by cranking the vasopressors or the levofed or whatnot, as opposed to, you know, giving fluid, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I'd absolutely agree with you. I think, you know, there's certainly situations where you're going to dissociate the cardiac output from the MAP. So if you over vasoconstrict people, you can, you know, push up their blood pressure, but meanwhile you can be decreasing their cardiac output. So I do think that there is definitely a phenomenon out there that exists in the universe that I think we've all seen of almost vasopressor-induced shock, where if you give people too many vasoconstrictors, you can, you know, drop their cardiac output and probably impair their perfusion. So I agree with you. I think a linear relationship of cardiac output to MAP is not really true. And then, you know, the other issue too is, you know, I think you're dealing in a way with three different things. You're dealing with the MAP, you're dealing with kind of the macrocirculatory cardiac output, and then you're dealing with the microcirculatory flow. And there may also be dissociations between the macrocirculatory cardiac output and the microcirculatory flow.
Right.
So it's really tricky.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think to the best of my knowledge, I haven't seen any way to come up with the definitive answer on how do you optimize this. I try to do some things using spectroscopy, cerebral spectroscopy, and try to sort of stay in that flat part, that sweet spot, let's say. And if I'm cranking the blood pressure and my cerebral fat, you know, everything else being equal, is starting to drop, but I'm concerned about over vasoconstriction, and sometimes try to match it with the modeling and things like that that you see on the skin, but it's very, very imperfect. But interestingly, I heard from John that you're doing something interesting yourself with a very visual way to quantify or get an idea about perfusion. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so they sell these infrared cameras on Amazon, and they're not that expensive. They're like $200 to $400. You can attach them to your iPhone, and it basically just gives you an infrared picture of the patients. So you can look at their hands, you can see if their hands are perfusing, you can look at their extremities, you can look at their knees. And it's almost like just an enhanced physical exam.
Right.
We were always taught, and you know, we always examine the patients to see if their extremities are warm, but
sure.
You know, I think at times, you know, one examiner will say, well, I think the extremities are warm, and someone else will say, I think they're cool, and, you know, I wouldn't be incredibly comfortable making big, you know, therapeutic decisions based on kind of something that seems subjective. So
right.
Adding that element of objectivity and taking a picture, I think in some ways can augment the physical exam and make it like a little bit more like, real.
That's actually an excellent point, because when I'd heard about it, I use extremities temperature all the time. I think it's mm-hmm. it's an important thing. But it hadn't even crossed my mind to think of that inter-observer variability has bound to be huge. Some people have cold hands, warm hands, so obviously, you know, it's gonna affect their sensation of it, which is an awesome point for this. And that's what I figured, that it must be just extending or augmenting, but the reliability and the objectivity of it is really a good point. And obviously, I think that helps us sort of in an etiological way, you know, whether it's for warm shock, cold shock, whatever. And have you looked at this in terms of any of the interventions that you're doing?
Yeah, occasionally, not a whole lot, not in a systematic way, but, you know, I posted this tweet, and sometimes, you know, I will encounter these patients who, kind of like we mentioned before, like they're on a ton of vasopressors, their extremities are cool, maybe they're a little mottled, they're not making good urine, and then you kind of put them on an inotrope, and, you know, suddenly they start perfusing and making urine and getting a whole lot better. So if you take pictures of them serially, you can sometimes see that change in perfusion. And it's neat because, you know, once again, this is just a physical exam, and I think it's, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago, people probably could have done the same thing, or you could do the same thing today if you were just, you know, feeling someone's feet and so on and so forth. But it's nice to have that objectivity of saying, this is what they were before, this is the temperature, this is the new temperature, and you can, you know, get some concepts of what's happening. You know, I have to, you know, put in a huge caveat here, which is that there's not a ton of evidence regarding this device and exactly,
of course,
you know, what normal ranges are and what represents a significant change and so on and so forth. None of that is really defined. So, you know, most of my decision-making is really based on the usual kind of clinical things. I think
sure.
It's just augmented slightly.
Sure. But, I remember there was a study that looked at knee modeling, and that they said they had broken it down into, I don't know, like three or four categories of severity. And it actually was, I think in that set, just as reliable for severity as, you know, lactate or whatnot. And so there's
yeah.
something there. And then did you find that, is there something more with knees than hands or feet, or are you?
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, there's multiple studies showing that knee modeling is a very strong predictor of mortality.
Right.
And you can see that pretty well with the camera. So I think it's something about the way the skin stretches over the knee. If you're hypoperfusing, the knee tends to be one of the first places that is hit.
Right.
So you can definitely look and, you know, you can see this kind of cold, you know, signature of like kind of hypoperfusion over the knee. And then, you know, sometimes, you know, now that I've paid more attention to this and I'm taking pictures of it, you know, once you see that, then you can look more carefully and you can see, yeah, you know, there is some subtle modeling there that I probably would have
mm-hmm.
missed if I was
right.
kind of like,
right.
you know, driving by. In the question, the really tantalizing question, you know, is exactly what is the significance of that? And some people have mentioned in review, like there was one review article that kind of mentioned the fact that, like, you know, if the patient's modeling, that probably suggests that, you know, they're really too vasoconstricted and their capillary beds are shutting down, and probably they need more inotropy. And I tend to believe that, but it would be nice if there was more evidence to show it.
Of course. Of course. That's very interesting. And, because the other thing is, we don't know, and that's always been my major query, we don't have a knowledge of what is the level of irreversible injury, right? Because
yeah.
I remember reading this really cool editorial article about this retired ICU guy that had gone off to do like essentially geriatrics or something, you know, radically different. And then he was pretty surprised at these cases of these patients that were, you know, not going to intervene or not going to do very much. And they were like hypotensive, shocky modeled, you know, with, you know, a little UTI or pneumonia or whatnot. And they just gave him antibiotics, and that was pretty much it. You know, let things go where they may. And, you know, that a significant proportion of those who would look like, you know, had they been rolled into the ICU, you know, you jump all over them, probably like a few years younger or whatever, you jump all over them, do all kinds of things, intubate them, put them, you know, give them a bunch of fluids and run them through that. So they looked like crap for like a couple of days, and then they turned a corner and they were back in their seat and doing their usual thing, you know, so that, you know, someone can look terrible, but we don't know how much is just reversible, and maybe you're better off just riding it out and not, you know, putting them through ARDS and multi-organ failure and all that stuff. So it's a really interesting question.
I completely agree, and I've had the same experience multiple times. And it would be really interesting to somehow do a review on these patients. So, you know, a fair number of times people come into the hospital, they'll have sepsis. And Vermonters, you know, they can be kind of stubborn at times, and they kind of know what they want. So I'll encounter these folks, and they're like, you know, I don't want to be intubated. I don't want to centralize. But, like, you're looking at this person, you're like, you know, you're, you know, independently functioning. Like, you know, you have a good quality of life. Like, I'm not just going to, like, do nothing. So oftentimes I'll say, you know what, we can take you to the ICU. I'll give you some peripheral phenylephrine. You know, we're not going to give you the 1,000, you know, liter fluid resuscitation. We'll kind of give you some gentle fluids, antibiotics, maybe some peripheral phenyl, a little bit of peripheral epi. And those patients often do shockingly well.
Right.
So I agree with you. I think, you know, it does, you know, raise the question of, you know, are there times that we're doing more harm than good with the super aggressive sepsis resuscitation?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously we agree on that, those guidelines, and, you know, we have to shout out again to the recently published article in the Annals, which I think hopefully gets read by some people and changes, sways some minds away from over-resuscitating and over-diagnosing.
Absolutely.
Are you planning on... I think I'm going to get the camera just to play around with it and for fun.
Yeah.
And I think we should be trying to correlate things and, you know, and see what links we can make, because I think that's a low-hanging fruit in a sense, and it's by being totally non-invasive. I think it's good. And I think... In medicine, it seems like a lot of people have gone to like this one pet thing that they like to do, you know, and it's almost religious. Like, well, I use the whatever, you know, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at like what's the safest industry on the planet is, you know, the aviation, and they have built-in systems of redundancy, you know, so they're looking at things in different angles, whether it's like, the weight of the wing and the fuel and the gauge itself and the whatever. Obviously, I don't know anything about it, but they have systems that are like multiples. And I think the more we build that in our, you know, critical care monitoring, the better, you know, especially since we don't even have a perfusion monitor per se. So very cool. Very interesting. There was something else I was going to ask you, slipping my mind now. Any other thoughts on the topic?
No, I mean, I have to admit, my approach to hemodynamics is relatively rudimentary. I don't have, you know, I'd have your cerebral O2 monitor, which seems pretty awesome, and I'd be interested in getting it, but, you know, I don't have a lot of, you know, really sophisticated tools, and I think the big thing, you know, that I'm missing, and I think a lot of people are missing, is a perfusion monitor. We rarely use swans, and I don't particularly like them. But even if we had a swan, you know, I don't think that would necessarily help me, because, like, if the cardiac output is X, I don't know what the cardiac output should be.
That's right.
So I think, like, the ideal perfusion monitor would provide us, not necessarily with, like, an absolute, but, like, is there enough relative perfusion? So I don't know. Maybe this will help. I think there's definitely a need for more research to kind of work on, you know, what the normal values are, how much of a change, you know, how much do things change randomly, you know, how much of a change is seen against. But this reminds me, by the way, of a story one of my pulmonary attendings, Tom Smith, used to tell me. So apparently when he was a resident or fellow at Vanderbilt a long time ago, they were doing, like, open-heart surgery cases or something, and, you know, everyone was getting a PA cath. And, you know, one of the anesthesiologists like to smoke or something. So after the case, he would go out and have a smoke, and he would come back, and all the younger anesthesiologists would be like looking at the PA, you know, the SWAN numbers and titrating stuff, and he'd just walk over and kind of put his hands on the patient's feet, and he'd be like, yeah, they're doing okay. So who knows?
Yeah.
He was right on the wall.
I think you have to integrate that stuff all in. I mean, I think the extremities to me is almost part of my, like, you know, as I approach, I'm going to feel a hand and foot. And I don't even know how I compute it in my head exactly, but I always do it, like, reflex.
Yeah. Although I would add, by the way, that, you know, any sort of hemodynamic monitor, you know, I think you mentioned this earlier, but just to kind of underline it, there are essentially two ways to use it. So one way is to differentiate different shock states. So, you know, your call to the ED of patients, you know, hypotensive, you know, is this warm shock or cold shock? And then the second thing is to, like, optimize their hemodynamics. And
yeah,
whatever tool you're using, it's much easier to get to the first approach, the first goal, than the second goal. The second goal is kind of the elusive, ephemeral thing that we're trying to do and often fails. And I think probably the number one utility of this would be to kind of try to differentiate warm and cold shock. For example, a couple months ago, there was a patient who was transferred up to the ICU with a saddle PE in shock. And, you know, I go and I evaluate this patient, and, like, the patient was, like, warm and vasodilated and hypotensive. I'm like, this really doesn't make
thumbs
sense.
Up, yeah.
You know, like, if someone has a PE, I would really expect their cardiac output to be low. So, you know, immediately we're like, you know, I think this is some sort of multifactorial shock state. So we ended up treating that patient with antibiotics and steroids and thrombolytics. We liked the PE, and it did turn out that the patient had, like, a combination of septic shock and PE. So
Right. Kind
of rolling in the door of the ICU, that was like a red flag that, you know, this isn't, you know, a straightforward case. And if you give this patient, you know, TPA, even if you, you know, fix the PE, that patient may not get better.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that is one of those things. You can't be dying of obstructive shock with warm extremities. Something doesn't
fit. Yeah.
And that reminds me, like, a decade ago, I was in Hawaii at the SCCM, and I had this chat with these people who were developing some form of transcutaneous monitor that was looking at the cytochrome, you know, oxidations and things like that, which I thought was really fascinating, because if you could have a look into the mitochondrial energetics, then I think you'd have a real answer. If you manage to put that whatever loop of monitoring through it, you know, the right tissues, then you could really know, and then you could probably be able to develop a bit of an idea of, well, when our mitochondria have whatever this level of activity or this pattern, they just don't recover from it. Then you could start to find that line where you need to just avoid that. And then no matter what the rest of the stuff is, no matter what the creatinine is, no matter whatever, they might recover from, you know, like most of our septic renal failure patients go back to having completely renal normal renal function. And, you know, that may be irrespective of what we do, or maybe it may be despite some of what we do. So, that could be really interesting stuff, but I haven't seen anything emerge from that field, yet.
Yeah. There's a lot of really interesting monitoring things that I would like to see. For example, like transcutaneous CO2. Have you used that at all? I've never used it.
No.
I mean, apparently it's used, I think it's used more in, like, the pediatric or neonatal ICU, but, you know, I wonder if in, you know, 2018, if someone could clean that up and get it to be a bit more accurate, if we could use that as a trending tool. Because, I mean, honestly, you know, like, when I was a resident, everyone wanted to get the PCO2 to 40 because, like, you wanted your attending to give you an apple or something. But
right.
I think as we go on, you realize, like, you know, I don't need that degree of precision. I just kind of want to know what direction it's going in. And
the direction.
I want to know if it's, yeah. So I'd be perfectly happy with a transcutaneous CO2 monitor, even if it wasn't, you know, ideal.
Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting, too. Okay. Well, I think we've certainly got some directional perspective, and I'm excited about ordering that up and trying it out and comparing with what you see. And
yeah, let me know.
Cool. All right. We'll do.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
No, thank you. All right. Bye-bye.